Mirror imaging. Mirror imaging is estimating how someone else will behave by projecting what you would do in the same situation. Framing your assessment with, "If I were Xi Jinping," or "If I were a Russian intelligence officer," is one of the greatest pitfalls in intelligence analysis and foreign policy decision-making. As former CIA analyst Frank Watanabe warned in his 15 Axioms for Intelligence Analysis, just because something seems like the logical conclusion or course of action to you does not mean that the person or group you are analyzing will see it that way. In May 1998, India tested a nuclear device for the first time in 24 years. U.S. intelligence agencies were so taken by surprise, they learned about the test in an Indian press release. It was a major intelligence failure. A high-level review found that mirror imaging played a significant role. Although the Indian government engaged in extensive denial and deception to hide test preparations, intelligence analysts were also deceived by their own thinking. They had assumed that the campaign promise of India's hardline party, the BJP, to test a nuclear weapon if it came to power was just talk. On the basis of the American experience, campaign pledges shouldn't be taken too seriously. Analysts reasoned the BJP would be unlikely to conduct an atomic test, risking economic sanctions and international opprobrium, since no American government in the same situation would. As Review Chairman Admiral David E. Jeremiah put it, "We should have been much more aggressive in thinking through how the other guy thought." Mirror imaging also led MacArthur, other policymakers, and CIA analysts astray in the Korean War. They believed the Chinese saw the costs and benefits of intervening just like they did, namely that air power gave American forces a decisive advantage over Chinese troops, and that Moscow would be reluctant to approve China's entry for fear of risking a global war between the two nuclear superpowers. And in the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, mirror imaging led both the Soviets and Americans to miscalculate, leaving the world at the nuclear brink. American estimators failed to see the world or weigh the costs and benefits of the missile deployment through Soviet eyes. And the Soviets appeared to make the same mistake when estimating how the United States would react. Between January and October 1962, when American U-2 spy planes discovered smoking gun evidence of nuclear missile sites in Cuba, the U.S. intelligence community produced 4 national intelligence estimates about Cuba. All of them assumed the Soviets' principal aim was defending Cuba from an American attack. Surely, analysts reasoned, the Soviets knew that deploying nuclear weapons to Cuba involved unacceptably high risks of discovery and a nuclear war with the United States. The Soviet Union would almost certainly never intend to hazard its own safety for the sake of Cuba, noted the March 21, 1962 estimate. None of the assessments considered whether Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev saw benefits to a nuclear deployment, such as gaining leverage over the status of a divided Berlin, embarrassing President Kennedy, exerting psychological pressure by basing nuclear weapons in the neighborhood, just as the United States had done to the Soviets in Europe, or compensating for Moscow's small and unreliable long-range nuclear arsenal by parking some of its more plentiful and reliable shorter-range missiles just 90 miles from the American homeland. Less is known about Soviet intelligence assessments, but it is clear that Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev reasoned he could get away with a nuclear fait accompli in Cuba without triggering a dangerous American response, exactly the opposite of what American intelligence analysts and policymakers actually thought. As Raymond Gartoff concluded, if Khrushchev and his colleagues had realized that Kennedy would do what he did do, they would never have made their decision to deploy the missiles. President Kennedy said he believed the odds of superpower nuclear war were somewhere between 1 out of 3 and even. historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. called the Cuban Missile Crisis the most dangerous moment in human history. Why? Because each side believed the other thought like they did. Framing biases, the trouble with numbers and words. Different people perceive the same numbers or words in very different ways. How a question is asked or how statistics are presented can lead to varying interpretations of likelihood and risk. When we moved from Los Angeles to Palo Alto, my 8-year-old daughter thought Northern California might finally give her the chance to see snow. Each morning, Kate would scour the weather forecast before breakfast and then inspect the car windshield, looking for frost, before we headed off to school. One day, she ran into the kitchen and declared excitedly, "It's going to snow! It's finally going to snow!" The weather forecast had indeed predicted a 10% chance of snow flurries. 10% didn't seem particularly likely to me, but for an 8-year-old hoping to make her first snow angel, 10% looked promising. Kate's snow hopes always remind me that information is never just information. For years, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and I taught a course on global risk management to Stanford MBAs. We sent this point home with an in-class experiment called the beauty pill exercise. We asked our students to imagine that we had invented a pill that could make them look their all-time best forever, whatever weight, hairstyle, or age that might be. Our beauty pill was rigorously tested and found to be 99.9% safe, with no side effects. How many would take it? Hands shoot up. Typically, all but one or two skeptical students jump at the chance to take the pill. Next, we tell them, what if we said there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that if you take this beauty pill, you will drop dead right here, right now? How many of you would still take it? This time, not many hands go up, even though, statistically speaking, 99.9% safe is exactly the same as a 1 in 1,000 risk of death. But 99.9% safe sounds a lot better than a 1 in 1,000 risk of instant death. With numbers and words, communication is rarely straightforward. Framing biases get in the way. The one exception I encountered was when I ran the beauty pill exercise with a couple hundred business executives in Texas and found a woman who kept her hand raised proudly in the air the whole time. She understood the statistics. "Oh, hell, I might die," she blurted, "but at least I'd die beautiful." Intelligence analysts have to deal with framing challenges all the time, whether they are writing a national intelligence estimate or briefing the White House. Analysts are asked to estimate the likelihood that something will or won't occur, even though the same words and numbers of estimative probability have different meanings for different people. Sherman Kent noted this phenomenon early in his CIA career. In March 1951, Kent and his team produced a national intelligence estimate on whether the Soviets would invade Yugoslavia after the communist government there broke from the Soviet Union. Kent and his team concluded that there was a serious possibility that the Kremlin would launch an attack on Yugoslavia. A few days later, a State Department official who had read Kent's estimate casually asked him what his team meant by a serious possibility. Kent had thought it was pretty clear and told him he felt the odds were about 65 to 35 in favor of a Soviet attack. His colleague was startled and said he took it to mean much lower odds. Confused, Kent went back to his team to ask what odds they each thought serious possibility indicated. The responses ranged anywhere from 80-20 in favor of an attack to the exact opposite. Kent wondered how it was possible they had all agreed on the same terminology and yet had come to such different conclusions. Horrified, Kent set out to make a chart, giving terms like certain and almost certain numerical values of estimated probability. The chart was never used. Some felt that reducing judgments to numbers seemed awkward and made intelligence estimates seem too much like gambling. Others raised concerns that numbers give a false sense that a judgment is an objective fact rather than a subjective probability estimate. Perhaps the most serious objection is what Tetlock calls the wrong side of maybe fallacy, the risk of being charged with failure when an event doesn't happen, even when the intelligence estimate claimed there was only a 70% chance that it would. When it comes to likelihood, we tend to conflate maybe with sure thing. After the Iraq WMD failure, the intelligence community overhauled its analytic tradecraft and the way in which national intelligence estimates were put together. In 2007, Intelligence Community Directive 203 established a number of new standards. Reforms required that analysts provide alternative analysis in the body of national intelligence estimates when appropriate, that they clearly express uncertainties and confidence levels in judgments, clearly denote existing assumptions in judgments, and include analysis about the quality and reliability of sources. But the intelligence community still presents judgments with words, not numbers. There's no easy way around framing biases. Words leave room for confusion, but numbers do too. Groupthink. All six of the seven deadly biases discussed so far afflict individuals. The seventh, groupthink, distorts collective judgment. Group dysfunction takes many forms for many reasons: clashing bureaucratic interests, poor leadership, and personality conflicts, to name a few. All of us have experienced unpleasant and unproductive groups in which leaders are too passive or too domineering. The group is too stressed out or too laid back, or some members argue too much or contribute too little. Although groupthink has become a popular catchphrase for bad group decisions of all kinds, it refers to a particular psychological pathology. When groupthink strikes, even smart, motivated, well-intentioned, rational individuals working in highly cohesive groups make poor collective decisions. How can this be? Because cohesion turns out to be a double-edged sword. The problem isn't that there's too much friction in the group, it's that there's too little. Irving Janis, the psychologist who coined the term groupthink in his classic study of the Vietnam War and other U.S. foreign policy fiascos, found that in high-pressure, high-stakes situations, the need for group affiliation and cohesion can assume overwhelming importance, fostering over-optimism, sloppy thinking, and an inflated sense of the group's morality. Maintaining group cohesion in the face of external pressures drives members to shy away from questioning, dissenting, and exploring alternative viewpoints, even though these are precisely the types of behaviors found to improve analysis. When groupthink arises, the whole becomes worse than the sum of the parts. The group runs smoothly into failure. One of the best documented cases of groupthink within the intelligence community was, once again, the assessment about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program in Iraq. The 2002 National Intelligence Estimate put it plainly, stating, "We judge that Iraq has continued its weapons of mass destruction programs in defiance of UN resolutions and restrictions." As discussed earlier, that sentence and many of its crucial underlying judgments about Saddam's nuclear, chemical, and biological programs turned out to be dead wrong. Michael Morell, who led the CIA's analytic branch from 2010 to 2013, wrote in his memoir that groupthink played a large role in the Iraq weapons of mass destruction intelligence failure. There were no outliers, no group with a different view, no one to force a broader debate that might have led to a more rigorous assessment on the part of the analysts, he wrote. Groupthink turned out to be a part of the problem. Other postmortems found that nobody ever created red teams or devil's advocates to challenge the prevailing view or surface alternative possibilities. In 12 years, not a single intelligence product examined whether anything might cause Saddam to destroy his weapons of mass destruction. As the Silberman-Robb Commission reported, failing to conclude that Saddam had ended his banned weapons program is one thing. Not even considering it as a possibility is another. An intellectual culture or atmosphere in which certain ideas were simply too unrespectable and out of sync with prevailing policy and analytic perspectives pervaded the intelligence community. To be sure, groupthink was not the only problem. The Iraq intelligence estimate suffered from a number of other weaknesses, including insufficient intelligence collection and poor vetting of information from unreliable human sources like Curveball. But groupthink played an important role, sending analysts down a path without sufficient skepticism about their evidence, assumptions, and arguments. When the calls are tough, the stress is high, and the evidence is murky, conformity feels reassuring. But it's a dangerous delusion. When everyone's agreeing, you should not be comforted. You should be worried. What do we got on that spacecraft that's good? Between the predictability spectrum and the seven deadly biases, intelligence analysis may seem a hopeless endeavor. It isn't. In the movie Apollo 13, when all hope seems lost after the spacecraft suffers a crippling explosion, NASA Tiger Team leader Gene Kranz turns to his engineering group at Mission Control and asks, "What do we got on the spacecraft that's good?" Realizing that it's not all bad is a useful place to start. Much about the human brain and collective decision-making works pretty well. The key is figuring out how to capitalize on those strengths and develop interventions that keep people from avoiding the pitfalls. Academics have been trying to figure out how to de-bias people and avert cognitive malfunctions for years, with mixed results. They found that simply informing people of their own cognitive biases isn't enough. Mental ruts are stubborn things. So, if knowing isn't enough, what debiasing efforts work better? The short answer appears to be three sets of things. Processes that nudge people to check their own biases and re-perceive what they see, formatting information in ways to increase understanding, and super forecasting training that includes practice and robust feedback. Scenarios, devils, and other re-perceiving tools. Business leaders, military officers, and intelligence officials use many process tools to check cognitive bias and better anticipate the future. Scenario planning is one of the most popular and best known. A 2014 Bain & Company global survey found that 18% of businesses said they used scenario planning already, and 60% said they expected to use it in the future. Developed by Ted Newland and Pierre Wack at Royal Dutch Shell in the 1970s, scenario planning is a systematic process that envisions three or four stories of alternative future worlds, each carefully researched to draw on diverse perspectives from a wide range of sources. The goal isn't to pinpoint the future. It's to view the future differently, getting analysts out of their mental ruts, identifying key drivers of change, and better understanding uncertainties. Newland and Wack's first scenario planning exercise in 1971 imagined a world where oil prices spiked, something most considered unthinkable at the time. But their exercise revealed a price hike was more likely than most people imagined, because optimistic projections were based on questionable assumptions about both demand and supply. A year after they finished, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, did raise oil prices dramatically, triggering an energy crisis. Thanks to scenario planning, Shell was the only company that was prepared for it, operationally, strategically, and emotionally. It's important to emphasize that scenarios are learning tools, not prediction tools. They're designed to help analysts re-perceive the world around them, to see causes, connections, and uncertainties in new ways. Scenario planning did not give Newland and Wack a crystal ball. It never even suggested when or why a price hike might occur. but the process did provide insight into macro forces that made a price hike more likely than most people assumed. American energy needs were rising, domestic supply was not, and OPEC consisted mostly of Arab countries in the unstable Middle East who had opposed Western support of Israel in the 1967 Six-Day War. Thinking like an outsider is another popular tool, especially for intelligence and defense officials. Red teams are groups that play the part of skeptics, competitors, or enemies. Some red teams are tasked with penetrating cybersecurity systems. Some pretend to be terrorists testing airport security procedures. Others scrub intelligence assessments, challenging every assumption, piece of information, hypothesis, and judgment. After 9/11, CIA Director George Tenet created a CIA Red Cell whose job was to generate out-of-the-box thinking that challenged conventional wisdom. Members were hand-picked and given wide latitude. As former Red Cell co-director Paul Frandano put it, "Tenet charged us to piss off senior analysts. If we weren't doing that, we weren't doing our jobs." Devil's advocates, like red teams, are designed to challenge conventional views, though usually in a less formalized, less structured way. The term originated in 1587 to improve the saint-making process of the Catholic Church. The Advocatus Diaboli served as the designated opponent to a sainthood candidate in an extensive process that often stretched over years, even decades. Today, devil's advocates are designated in-house dissenters. Although real devils are better than designated ones, genuine dissent is more powerful than ritualized dissent, devil's advocates can still play a useful role. For years, the intelligence community has used these and other process tools to confront cognitive bias. Together, these methods are called structured analytic techniques, or SATs. They include everything from simple checklists designed to surface and validate implicit assumptions to alternative competing hypotheses, a process that arrays each piece of evidence and every reasonable hypothesis in a matrix so that analysts can see whether pieces of information could be consistent or inconsistent with multiple hypotheses. Using the analytic techniques contained in this primer will assist analysts in dealing with the perennial problems of intelligence, the complexity of international developments, incomplete and ambiguous information, and the inherent limitations of the human mind, notes the CIA's 2009 Analytic Tradecraft Primer. However, it's hard to gauge the effectiveness of any of these tools. Combating one bias, like overconfidence, may leave analysts vulnerable to another, like underconfidence. Information format matters. Psychologists have found that the way in which problems are presented can activate or overcome cognitive biases. As we saw in the beauty pill exercise, information format matters. This is especially true when it comes to probabilities that tend to stump even highly educated experts. Consider this classic example. The probability of breast cancer is 1% for a woman at age 40 who participates in routine screening. If a woman has breast cancer, the probability is 80% that she will get a positive mammography. If a woman does not have breast cancer, the probability is 9.6% that she will also get a positive mammography. A woman in this age group had a positive mammography in a routine screening. What's the probability that she actually has breast cancer? Students, doctors, and even the staff at Harvard Medical School had trouble answering the question correctly. One study found that 95 out of 100 doctors estimated the probability to be between 70 and 80%. The correct answer is 7.8%. That's right, 7.8%. In this hypothetical, the probability that a woman who has tested positive for breast cancer in a routine mammography actually has breast cancer is less than 8%. In their seminal paper, Gigerenzer and Hoffridge find that the way in which probability problems like the breast cancer diagnosis are usually presented makes it harder to understand base rates and get the right answer. Gigerenzer and Hoffridge found that when the probabilities were presented as natural sampling schematics, the math became much easier to see, and estimating errors declined significantly. The secrets of superforecasting. After the Iraq weapons of mass destruction intelligence failure, the U.S. intelligence community launched several initiatives to improve intelligence analysis. One of them was commissioning a National Research Council study by academic experts from different fields to examine the most promising ideas in the social sciences and recommend ways for the intelligence community to adopt them. I was one of the experts on the study, and I jumped at the chance to spend 2.5 years examining how the intelligence community could improve its thinking about thinking. It's not every day that secret intelligence agencies ask outsiders for help, and it's not every day that a political scientist like me gets the chance to collaborate with and learn so much from psychologists, historians, engineers, lawyers, and intelligence leaders. One of our recommendations was that the intelligence community needed to test its analytic methods in a rigorous way to see whether and how and why some approaches worked better than others. It's hard to improve intelligence analysis if you don't know what works and what doesn't. We even recommended the creation of a recurring intelligence community analytic Olympics to send home the message that fostering a culture of continuous evaluation and learning should be championed. There are about 20,000 analysts across the intelligence community making thousands of estimates about geopolitical developments every year. And yet, the intelligence community had never assessed which of these forecasts were right, which weren't, and why. There were understandable reasons why this didn't happen. As I've mentioned, judging success or failure in the intelligence business is tricky, to say the least. It's also politically charged. It doesn't take much to imagine how a well-meaning evaluation effort could be misconstrued and misused, conjuring headlines like CIA analysis of country X found to be deficient, or new study finds Y percent of intelligence analysts don't understand probabilities. Evaluating debiasing tools in university experiments with undergraduate volunteers is one thing. Evaluating real-life analytic methods used by career intelligence professionals confronting high-stakes national security threats is quite another. No undergraduate has ever been charged with failing the country, been hauled before Congress, or suffered a major career setback for answering a few questions one day in exchange for a $10 Amazon gift card. Still, the lack of testing meant that intelligence analysts lacked robust feedback loops to learn from the past and improve their accuracy in the future. Instead, performance was measured by whether analysts used the right processes, like considering alternative explanations and making their assumptions explicit. To their credit, several intelligence officials ran with the idea of testing after a report came out. They approached one of our panel members, Phil Tetlock, the expert judgment expert. Tetlock at the time had recently finished a 20-year study examining how well experts forecasted the future. It was the first large-scale scientific experiment of judgment ever conducted. In it, Tetlock asked a group of nearly 300 experts to make thousands of predictions about economic and political issues of the day, nearly 82,000 predictions in all. His main finding was depressing. The average expert was about as accurate as a dart-throwing chimpanzee, and their predictions were about the same as random guessing. The chimpanzee discovery made headlines and became something of a sensation. Less noticed was Tetlock's other finding. Predicting the future wasn't just lucky guessing. Some people did much, much better than average. He called them super forecasters. In 2011, the intelligence community launched a forecasting tournament to better understand what makes some people better forecasters than others. Over the next 4 years, 5 teams competed, answering questions every morning, ranging from the price of oil at a given time to the prospects of conflict between China and Japan in the East China Sea. There were nearly 500 questions in all. The winner was the team with the best accuracy at predicting things that did not happen, as well as things that did happen. Tetlock and his colleague Barbara Mellers put together a team of thousands of volunteers called the Good Judgment Project. The University of Michigan and MIT each fielded a team. The intelligence community did too. The fifth team was a control group. By varying the experimental conditions, we could gauge which factors improved foresight by how much, over which time frames, and how good forecasts could become if the best practices were layered on top of each other, Tetlock later reflected. By the end of the second year, the results were staggering. Tetlock's volunteer team was winning, by a lot. They outperformed other university-affiliated teams at Michigan and MIT by such large margins, 30 to 70%, the other schools were dropped from the competition. Tetlock's team also beat professional intelligence analysts with access to classified data. The best of the best on Tetlock's team, the super forecasters, were not geniuses with multiple PhDs. They were artists and scientists, students and retirees, Wall Streeters and Main Streeters, as Tetlock put it. They included a retired IBM computer programmer who liked to drive his red Mazda Miata around, and an Agriculture Department bureaucrat who lived in Nebraska and loved bird watching. Tetlock found that the secret to success wasn't sky-high brilliance or a Jeopardy-like mastery of news and facts. It wasn't what super forecasters knew. It was how they thought. Super forecasters are far more open-minded, curious, careful, and self-critical than the average bear. They believe that reality is complex, that nothing is certain or inevitable, and that ideas should always be subjected to evidence, testing, and updating. They have what Tetlock calls dragonfly eyes, the ability to see a problem with the 30,000 lenses of a dragonfly's eye. While high-functioning groups harness the wisdom of different perspectives that each member brings, super forecasters can harness the wisdom of different perspectives from within, all by themselves. Perhaps most encouraging, Tetlock and his colleagues have since found in their experiments that super forecasting skills can be learned through training, practice, measurement, and feedback. One basic 60-minute tutorial improved accuracy by 10% through a tournament year. That may not seem like a lot, but imagine if your financial advisor told you she could guarantee a 10% better return on your investments than anyone else. Or imagine if you had a 10% better chance of getting a promotion at work than all the other candidates. Or imagine you're an 8-year-old hoping for snow in California. When it comes to forecasting important things, 10% can be larger than you think and cause for optimism. Artificial intelligence and the future of analysis. Humans are also getting help from machines. Advances in artificial intelligence offer potential game-changing capabilities to process volumes of data at radically new speeds and scales, identify patterns across data sooner and more easily, and empower human analysts in new ways. As noted in Chapter 1, intelligence has gone from a world of information scarcity to information overload. Today, data is everywhere, captured by cameras on city streets, selfies on social media, sensors in space, and billions of communications transiting the internet each day. According to the World Economic Forum, 44 zettabytes of data have already accumulated in the digital universe. That's a number so big, it has 21 zeros. It's 40 times more bytes of data than stars in the observable universe. We're a long way from Douglas MacArthur's days of paper reports and typewriters. Sense-making increasingly requires sifting the wheat from the chaff of this vast digital world, and AI tools are well-equipped to assist. Already, algorithms can recognize patterns in vast amounts of data at superhuman speeds. In a 2017 U.S. intelligence pilot program, for example, an algorithm identified Chinese surface-to-air missile sites over a 35,000-square-mile area 80 times faster than the human team, with the same level of accuracy. During 2020-2021, I served on an expert task force that examined future intelligence challenges and opportunities arising from emerging technologies. The task force's research included dozens of interviews and deep dive sessions with technology leaders and intelligence experts across the U.S. government, the private sector, and academia. We found that AI and its associated technologies, such as cloud computing, advanced sensors, and big data analytics, could transform every core intelligence mission. For analysis, machine learning algorithms could summarize streams of news articles, highlighting issues that intelligence analysts might not otherwise notice or have time to read. Algorithms could more rapidly mine foreign social media data for crisis monitoring and analyze data more continuously to detect smaller changes in patterns, suggesting something might be afoot. They could offer algorithmic red teams to test human analysis against machine-derived patterns and insights, and more. We also found that the greatest promise of AI comes from augmenting human analysts, not replacing them. By automating mundane tasks that absorb tremendous amounts of time, AI has the potential to free human analysts to concentrate on higher-level thinking that only humans can do well, like assessing an adversary's intentions, considering broader context, examining competing hypotheses, and identifying what evidence may be missing. Harnessing the power of artificial intelligence and other new technologies to improve analysis will not be easy, both because there are always weaknesses in technologies and because there are always deep-seated impediments to adopting them, however beneficial they might be. Even the most advanced AI algorithms have severe limitations, including the inability to explain how they reach results and the tendency to fail unexpectedly in the face of seemingly small changes, like mistaking a picture of a sloth for a race car when imperceptible changes are made to the image. AI also raises important ethical concerns that warrant careful consideration about uses, policies, and limits. And adoption requires overcoming large technical, bureaucratic, and cultural hurdles inside the intelligence community, from bespoke computer systems that cannot operate across agencies to archaic technology acquisition policies that take too long and make buying new products too hard, to cultural aversion to change. No organization adapts easily. Companies fail to adjust to market conditions, competitors, and new technologies so often that on average, 550,000 businesses fail in the United States each year. That's more than a company every minute. Even leading organizations are not immune. Bethlehem Steel, Blockbuster Video, Enron, and Lehman Brothers were all one-time giants that didn't survive. Government agencies have an even harder time adapting than companies because they lack the three most powerful tools for success: control over their own mission and budgets, leeway to make rapid changes in the workforce, and a market imperative to adapt or die. Yet these barriers must be overcome for American intelligence agencies to succeed. A new sense-making race has already begun, with adversaries rapidly adopting AI and other new technologies, leaving U.S. intelligence agencies behind the curve. "If you want to know my great fear about China," said Susan Gordon, who served as the second highest official in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence from 2017 to 2019, "it's that because they both steal and collect so much data, and they now have essentially equivalent computing capability, they're getting practice with data that we're not." In a world of ubiquitous data, AI will transform how analysis is done and who will gain the edge. As Gordon put it, How does an intelligence community not be the best in the world of data? How are we not better at using it, finding it, assessing it, protecting it, ensuring it than everyone else? Trying not to fool ourselves. Physicist Richard Feynman once said that analysis is how we try not to fool ourselves. He's right. Estimating the future will always be a hazardous occupation, especially in intelligence. No analyst, however skilled, can ever fully know the internal pressures, thinking, aims, and maneuvers of an adversary. The world outside is hard to predict, and the world inside our own minds is prone to error. But failure is not inevitable. Trying not to fool ourselves is a worthy endeavor, and evidence suggests it is likely to get better as we learn more about the processes and practices that make some individuals and groups more accurate than others, and as new technologies enhance the quest for insight. Chapter 6, Counterintelligence, To Catch a Spy. Never go home at night without wondering where the mole is. Robert Gates, CIA Director, 1991 to 1993. Robert Hansen seemed an unlikely traitor. The son of a Chicago police officer, he majored in chemistry and went to graduate school in dentistry before getting his MBA from Northwestern University. In 1976, after stints as an accountant and a police officer, Hansen joined the FBI, where he worked for the next 25 years. Colleagues found him socially awkward, but smart, with a strong interest in computers. Hansen was a devoted husband, a father of 6 children, and a devout Catholic who went to Mass almost every day. He walked the family dog and lived in a modest, split-level home in suburban Virginia. "He was a great dad," said his daughter. Hansen was also a great liar. He started spying for the Soviet Union back in 1979, not long after joining the FBI, and lived a double life for nearly half his life. Then, one cold night in 2001, that double life came to an end. On February 18th, just 5 weeks before his retirement, Hansen walked into Foxstone Park, a quiet, leafy area near his house, and hid a small garbage bag under a bridge. The bridge was a dead drop, a prearranged location for him to pass secret documents to his Russian spy masters without risking a face-to-face meeting. 10 FBI agents were secretly watching in the woods. As soon as Hansen placed his package, the arrest team surrounded him, cuffed him, and read him his Miranda rights. After a 15-year mole hunt, they had finally caught their traitor. Hansen pleaded guilty to spying for Moscow on and off for 22 years, throughout his FBI career, and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The damage was substantial. Hansen was found to have betrayed at least 4 Russian agents working for U.S. intelligence, 3 of whom were executed as a result of his treachery. Using dead drops around New York and Washington, Hansen handed over more than 6,000 pages of classified documents and 26 computer diskettes detailing U.S. nuclear war preparations, U.S. operations and techniques to recruit Soviet intelligence officers and evaluate double agent operations, dozens of other technical and human intelligence operations, and the existence of a billion-dollar eavesdropping tunnel beneath the Soviet embassy in Washington. Hansen is still considered the most damaging mole in FBI history. In return for spilling America's secrets, he received gems and up to $1.4 million in cash, some of which he used on lavish trips and jewelry and a silver Mercedes-Benz for a stripper named Priscilla. Traitors have always held a special fascination in the public conscience, while creating a special challenge for intelligence officials. When trusted insiders become turncoats, the damage can be devastating. The betrayal is personal, and the job of catching them is painful. As former CIA counterintelligence chief James Olson noted, counterintelligence can be an excruciatingly frustrating profession. You lose when you win. You feel good about uncovering spies in our midst, but you are then inevitably hit with the cutting follow-up questions. How could you let that happen? Wasn't it your job to prevent things like that? As Hansen was being arrested, the notoriously arrogant FBI agent took the time to deliver a final insult to his counterintelligence colleagues, asking them, "What took you so long?" This chapter examines counterintelligence from the old days to the cyber age. As we'll see, catching traitors is just one part of the counterintelligence mission. We begin by taking a step back and examining what counterintelligence is and how it's done, from mundane procedures to exotic devices and operations. Then we'll tackle a burning question: what motivates people to betray their country or cause? Finally, we examine three key counterintelligence challenges: trust, paranoia, and technology. What is counterintelligence? As its name suggests, counterintelligence is the art of countering the intelligence activities of others. By protecting your own secrets through security and guile, disrupting others' intelligence operations, penetrating their organizations, and manipulating their perceptions and activities. Intelligence and counterintelligence are two sides of the same coin. Intelligence seeks to collect and analyze information to give one side insight and advantage. Counterintelligence seeks to protect those capabilities and deny them to others. One side's intelligence success is the other side's counterintelligence failure. Hollywood often gets the real world of espionage wrong, and the use of the word spy is a prime example. Spies are not CIA officers who meet with their Chinese or Russian sources in dark alleyways. Spies are the Chinese or Russian sources. Spies are also often called assets or agents. They are people who betray their home country's cause for a foreign one. Intelligence officers who manage spies for a living are called handlers or spy masters. At the CIA, these officers are members of the National Clandestine Service, and they are officially called operations officers or case officers. The primary job of a case officer is not to steal secrets herself. It's to convince foreign nationals to steal secrets and hand them over. Why? Because foreign nationals live on the inside of an intelligence target. They can get into positions of power or proximity, granting them access to streams of sensitive foreign information that would be difficult or impossible to obtain any other way. Spies can be a foreign engineer working on next-generation missile systems, a foreign jihadist operating inside a terrorist cell, a foreign military officer, or a foreign leader's cook, half-brother, or mistress, to name a few. The job of a case officer is to identify, recruit, and run spies, figuring out how to keep them working and keep them safe from detection. It's an intimate, complicated, and high-stakes relationship. Spies who get caught are imprisoned or executed. From a counterintelligence perspective, one nation's spy is another nation's mole or traitor. Robert Hansen was a spy for the Soviets and Russians. He was a mole and a traitor to the United States. It's also important to remember that everyone spies, and counterintelligence must be aimed not just at adversaries, but at allies as well. As the CIA's former counterintelligence chief, James Olson, notes, in counterintelligence, there are friendly countries, but there are no friendly intelligence services. With only a handful of exceptions, everyone spies on everyone else, friends and foes alike. The handful of exceptions are the Five Eyes partners, who share a very close intelligence relationship: the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Otherwise, it's an intelligence jungle out there. At least 80 countries are known to have conducted intelligence operations against the United States, including allies like France, South Korea, and Israel. In the 1980s, Israel strained relations with the United States for the next 30 years by running an American spy named Jonathan Pollard. A civilian Navy intelligence analyst, Pollard passed hundreds of classified documents to the Israelis, including American assessments of the military capabilities of Israel and other Middle Eastern states. Then one day, an alert coworker saw Pollard carrying what looked like a classified envelope into the parking lot and reported him. Pollard was arrested in 1985 and became the only American ever sentenced to life in prison for spying on behalf of an ally. For years, Israeli leaders lobbied for his release, and for years, American leaders refused. In the 1990s, Israel even tried to make Pollard's freedom part of Middle East peace talks, prompting then CIA Director George Tenet to threaten to resign if President Clinton agreed. In 2015, after serving 30 years of his life sentence, Pollard was released from prison, and in 2020, his parole ended, clearing the way for him to move to Israel. Today, according to former U.S. intelligence officials, 2 to 3 million people are engaged in espionage around the world, most of them aiming at the United States. China, Russia, Cuba, and Iran are the most aggressive foreign intelligence services seeking to steal American secrets. Of them, China stands apart as the most serious counterintelligence threat. American military experts have said that there isn't a single major Chinese weapon system that isn't based on stolen U.S. technology. In 2015, China was behind the most damaging counterintelligence cyber attack yet known, a hack that stole over 21 million security clearance records from the Office of Personnel Management, the agency that oversees federal human resources management, including background investigations for security clearances. It was a counterintelligence nightmare for the United States, giving China highly sensitive information about Americans serving in government, including their debts, medical records, foreign friends, relatives, and other information that could be used to coerce them. Government agencies are not the only targets. Chinese cyber and human espionage activities have penetrated corporations and universities, too, seeking to steal everything from COVID-19 research to missile chips. By the summer of 2020, Chinese spying had become so rampant, the FBI was opening a new China-linked counterintelligence investigation about every 10 hours. China is active, but not alone. The 2019 threat assessment issued by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence warned that the United States faces a complex global foreign threat environment, and that technological advances are enabling more states and non-state actors to steal information to the detriment of U.S. interests. The 2016 National Counterintelligence Strategy noted that global supply chains and communications have made information and assets essential to American national security more distributed and vulnerable. At the same time, hostile intelligence services have more tools at their disposal for stealing and exploiting sensitive data. Defensive and offensive counterintelligence. Counterintelligence can be divided roughly into two sets of activities: defensive or passive counterintelligence, which consists chiefly of security measures, and offensive counterintelligence, which involves infiltrating a hostile intelligence service to understand how it operates and thwart its activities through disruption and deception. It's important to note that counterintelligence is not just about blocking and tackling to protect our own side. Done well, counterintelligence opens new opportunities to gather information, deceive the opponent, and gain advantage. Defensive counterintelligence. Defensive counterintelligence measures range from the mundane to the exotic. Safes, locked rooms, checkpoints, armed guards, electric fences, motion detectors, hydraulic anti-truck devices, and attack dogs are common features at intelligence facilities. Classified documents never get tossed into regular garbage cans. They are placed in burn bags to be incinerated at the end of every workday. Visit a classified facility like CIA headquarters or the nuclear command bunker at United States Strategic Command in Nebraska, and you'll find the desks are weirdly clean. Nobody leaves their classified work open on a computer screen or on a table when someone without a clearance is around. Visitors can feel a bit like criminals. They're never left alone. And in some classified facilities, red lights flash in the hallways when someone uncleared is inside, just to make sure everyone knows. Of course, work has to get done in all sorts of places outside these secure facilities. Because foreign policy never sleeps, senior government officials have to work from home late at night. Presidents and their foreign policy teams travel overseas. Members of the Congressional Intelligence Committees need to view classified documents near their offices. Defense contractors have to make and discuss classified weapons systems in their factories. Sensitive compartmented information facilities, or SCIFs, are special rooms designed and built to keep secrets secret in these and other far-flung locations. Built according to strict construction guidelines that include acoustic protections, SCIFs are often located inside otherwise open or ordinary buildings, like offices, homes, or hotels. SCIFs can be permanent or temporary. They've been built in boats, trailers, even tents. Cell phones are not allowed inside a SCIF to ensure classified information cannot be duplicated and conversations cannot be recorded. There are often cubbies watched by a guard outside SCIFs for depositing phones and other connective devices. Other defensive counterintelligence measures aren't so visible. In his 2008 book, The Shadow Factory, James Bamford recounts some of the counterintelligence measures built into National Security Agency headquarters. It sounds fictional, but it's all real. Modern and boxy, it has a shiny black glass exterior that makes it look like a giant Rubik's Cube. But hidden beneath the dark reflective finish is the real building, a skin-like cocoon of thick, orange-colored copper shielding to keep all signals or any other type of electromagnetic radiation from ever getting out. Known by the codename Tempest, this protective technique was designed to prevent electronic spies from capturing any escaping emissions. The windows of the director's office contained hair-thin copper wires to seal in even the faintest electronic whisper, and to prevent sophisticated laser devices from capturing the telltale vibration of the director's voice on the glass, music played between the panes. Defensive counterintelligence also involves people, not just buildings. Vetting your own employees through background investigations and security clearances is essential and difficult. One challenge is scale. In 2017, 4 million people in the United States held security clearances, giving them access to classified information. That's more than the entire population of Los Angeles. While clearance backlogs have been shrinking, in 2019, the number of people awaiting security clearances was about 500,000, and the fastest top-secret clearances still took more than a year to process, 468 days, to be exact. A second challenge is identifying the best methods to assess trustworthiness. Polygraphs, or lie detector tests, are widely used but controversial, drawing support from many intelligence and law enforcement officials, but deep skepticism from the scientific community. The tests record physiological responses to yes-no questions, typically by measuring the respondent's respiration, heart rate, blood pressure, and skin sweatiness. But polygraphs do not test deception directly. And contrary to conventional wisdom, there is no unique physiological response known to indicate lying. In fact, the test itself can produce anxiety that leads respondents to fail even when they're being truthful. At the same time, others who do not exhibit expected physiological responses can pass polygraph tests even when they are being deceptive. Aldrich Ames, a CIA officer who secretly worked for the Russians, passed two polygraphs while he was betraying some of America's most important secrets, treachery that led to the deaths of at least 10 people. Anna Montes, a Defense Intelligence Agency analyst who spied for Cuba, also passed polygraph tests, as did 24 Cubans who American officials thought were spying for the United States, but were in fact double agents spying for Havana. In 2003, an expert panel from the National Academy of Sciences conducted a comprehensive study examining the scientific validity and reliability of polygraphs for employment screening. The study concluded that there is little basis for the expectation that a polygraph test could have extremely high accuracy, and that polygraph testing is intrinsically susceptible to producing erroneous results in both directions, failing people who are telling the truth or false positives, and passing people who are lying or false negatives. Yet many intelligence agencies still use polygraphs. In fact, the FBI expanded the use of polygraphs after the Hansen case. Defenders say the test provides a helpful deterrent and one input into a broader system designed to identify past or ongoing behavior, such as debts, alcoholism, marital troubles, that could indicate that an employee might be susceptible to working for a hostile intelligence service, terrorist group, or other organization operating against the United States government. As former CIA Director William Colby put it, "I don't believe in the polygraph, but it sure as hell helped us. My security people told me that, faced with the polygraph, people told us things that caused us not to hire them. As far as I'm concerned, it paid for itself right there." Offensive counterintelligence. Offensive counterintelligence is more aggressive and dynamic. It involves uncovering how foreign intelligence services operate against American officers, detecting American traitors, and penetrating hostile intelligence services and organizations with our own spies, foreign nationals willing to betray their country or cause for ours. Good counterintelligence also looks ahead, imagining and planning for all of the devious scenarios adversaries might use in the future to recruit American traitors. And it requires asking whether any source, however valuable the information may seem, can really be trusted. Former CIA Director Michael Hayden referred to his regular counterintelligence briefings, which reviewed cases, leads, and suspicions, as the most depressing 90 minutes on my calendar. In counterintelligence, the most vulnerable moments usually come when spies are trying to communicate with their handlers. Tradecraft to hide these communications is designed to reduce the risks of discovery. Techniques include surveillance, dead drops, coded communications, and signal sites where a case officer places a predetermined mark, often with chalk or tape, in a public location to let a spy know that a package is ready to be picked up or that the spy needs to make contact. These techniques take considerable training and time to develop. Observing an opposition intelligence service without being made is excruciatingly difficult, wrote Olson, the former CIA counterintelligence chief. Olson insisted his teams have at least a year in the city of operation before he would allow them to start surveillance operations there. A single 24-hour FBI surveillance operation of one terrorist suspect or foreign intelligence officer takes more than 24 people. The best way to uncover traitors at home is by penetrating hostile intelligence services abroad. As counterintelligence officials have noted, it takes a mole to catch a mole. That's how the FBI ultimately caught Robert Hansen. For years before Hansen's 2001 arrest, The FBI and CIA knew that someone in the U.S. government was handing over vital secrets to the Russians. They worked furiously to find the mole, without success, spending 3 years chasing the wrong man, a CIA officer named Brian Kelly. It wasn't until the FBI paid a former Russian intelligence officer $7 million for a KGB intelligence file about an American mole that counterintelligence officials got the leads that broke the case. Even that required an elaborate counterintelligence effort. To get the file, the FBI narrowed down the list of KGB intelligence officers who might have known the mole's identity, focused on any who had retired, since active officers would have been even more difficult to recruit, found one who fit the criteria and started a business in Moscow, and then convinced an American business executive to send a sham invitation inviting the Russian to meet him in the United States to discuss expanding the business. It worked. When the Russian landed in New York, he was met by FBI agent Mike Rochford, who recruited him to give up the goods. The Russian file did not have Hansen's name because Hansen, well-versed in counterintelligence tradecraft, had never given his name to his handlers, referring to himself only as B, or a pseudonym, Ramon Garcia, in his communications. He also refused to meet with Russian intelligence officers in person for 2 decades, sending messages and materials only by dead drops. And Hansen used his position in counterintelligence at the FBI to check computer files about whether he was under suspicion. But the $7 million file did contain 3 gold nuggets. The first was an audio recording of the unidentified mole's voice talking with a KGB officer. The second was the mole's fingerprint, which was lifted from one of the garbage bags used to wrap his dead drop materials. The third was a set of notes showing the mole had twice referred to an off-color quote by General George S. Patton. The voice matched Hansen's. The fingerprint was run through the FBI database and came back a match for Hansen. And an FBI analyst remembered Hansen using the same Patton quote in conversations at work. What makes traitors tick? Why did they do it? That's the question family, friends, colleagues, and counterintelligence officials invariably ask when a trusted insider goes bad. Human motives are complex, and spies often try to justify their actions after the fact. Yet most counterintelligence experts find 4 major types of motives that conveniently fit into the acronym MICE: money, ideology, compromise, and ego. Greed has long been a powerful driver for all sorts of human behavior. America's first known traitor, Benjamin Church, sold secrets to the British to support his mistress and his otherwise costly lifestyle. More recently, a Defense Department study found that more than 200 Americans have been convicted of espionage-related charges from 1947 to 2015. Money was at the top of that list, too, serving as the sole or primary motive for nearly half of them, including Robert Hansen, Aldrich Ames, who received $4.6 million from the Russians, and Kevin Mallory, a former employee of the CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, State Department, and U.S. Army with a top-secret clearance, who was indicted in 2018 for turning over classified information to the Chinese. "Your object is to gain information," he texted his Chinese handlers, "and my object is to be paid for it." Ideology has also been a common motive. In the 1930s and 1940s, a number of Americans and British betrayed their countries because they sympathized with the communist cause. These included the infamous Cambridge spies, Donald MacLean, Guy Burgess, Harold Kim Philby, Anthony Blunt, and John Kencross, all students at Cambridge University who went on to serve in the British government and use their positions to pass secret information to the Soviets for years. Their espionage included betraying some of the most sensitive American secrets and operations, such as plans for the atomic bomb, military strategies for the Korean War, and American counterintelligence operations. Eventually, all five Soviet spies were caught, but it took 3 decades to uncover Philby, after he had served in some of the most senior and sensitive positions in British intelligence. He had even been interrogated by MI5 and MI6 in 1951, after Burgess and MacLean were uncovered, but he was exonerated. It wasn't until 1962 that British agents finally confronted him and offered him immunity from prosecution if he told what he knew. Philby agreed, but then fled to Russia on a ship sent by the KGB. He became a Russian citizen and was buried with the honors of a KGB general after his death in 1988. Belief in a foreign cause also drove Julius Rosenberg, who joined the Young Communist League when he was growing up, to reveal atomic secrets of the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb. More recently, Jerry Chun Shing Lee, a Hong Kong native and naturalized U.S. citizen who served in the CIA for more than a decade, was motivated by ideology to spy for China. The Defense Department study of American traitors found that ideology, which included divided loyalties to another country or cause, ranked second, constituting the sole or primary motive for 25% of convicted spies. Others ended up spying for foreign powers for a host of reasons, including coercion by a foreign intelligence service that has compromising information on them, because they feel disgruntled, unappreciated, and unrecognized at work, because they seek the sheer thrill of it, or because they are trying to ingratiate themselves with someone, perhaps a romantic interest or an admired friend. Motives, of course, are often tangled. Benedict Arnold was known to have an extraordinary ego, deep grievances over politically motivated investigations against him, financial pressures, and a young new loyalist wife he wanted to impress. Aldrich Ames, the former CIA officer who spied for Russia, did it to pay off debts accumulated by his luxurious lifestyle. But ego also played a role. As he later explained in interviews, "I did it for the money, not because of what it could buy, but because of what it said about me." It said Rick Ames was not a failure. Evidence suggests that motives have been shifting since the Cold War's end, with ideology or divided loyalties playing a larger role than it once did, and money declining in importance. During the Cold War, money was the sole or primary motive for 54% of those convicted of committing espionage-related crimes. But since 1990, it has been the primary motivation for just 37% of traitors. By contrast, ideological commitment to another cause was responsible for just 20% of espionage-related convictions of Americans during the Cold War, but 35% of spy cases since 1990. A few other demographic factors are worth noting. American traitors are almost always men. Since 1947, only 18 of 209 American spies convicted of espionage-related crimes have been women. Traitors also tend to be middle-aged and married. And 57% of the time, they volunteered to become spies rather than being recruited by foreign intelligence services.